Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're your shortcut to understanding what's buzzing on Hacker News.
That's right.
It's Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025.
And we've got quite a lineup today.
We really do. It's quite the mix from the front page. We're talking about a seriously old bug in GTA San Andreas popping up in Windows 11.
Yeah, that one's wild.
Then there's the whole debate around stealing fonts, surprisingly passionate stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Plus a whistleblower story involving the NLRB and some questionable code.
Definitely concerning.
A skeptical look at AI assistants. Are they just horseless carriages?
Interesting analogy.
And finally, Apple and Meta getting hit with big EU fines over the Digital Markets Act.
Yeah, the DMA enforcement is really kicking in.
So quite a range.
Yeah.
Let's jump right in.
Sounds good. Hacker News really does give you that snapshot, doesn't it? From deep technical weeds to big picture policy.
Absolutely. Okay, first up, this Grand Theft Auto bug, 20 years old from San Andreas, suddenly causing problems in Windows 11 24H2. That's unexpected.
It really is. It perfectly illustrates how software issues can just lie dormant for, well, decades.
So what was the actual bug?
It's a floating point underflow. Think of it like trying to represent a number that's way, way too small, practically zero, but like super negative in a system that has limits.
Okay.
In the game's code for loading vehicles, specifically the crop duster plane, if the blade angle calculation resulted in this extremely large negative number, boom.
Underflow. On one specific plane's blade angle, that's incredibly specific.
Exactly. Must be a rare scenario. And when it underflows, it messed up a function called scanf, which reads formatted text.
Scanf, right. Classic C function.
Yeah. And because of the underflow, scanf ended up trying to read from memory that hadn't been properly set up an uninitialized variable.
Reading garbage data, basically.
Pretty much. And that garbage data led the game straight into an infinite loop, freeze city.
And this just sat there
yeah.
for 20 years through Windows XP, Vista 7, 8, 10.
Apparently so. It seems the conditions were rare, and previous Windows versions handled things slightly differently.
So what changed in Windows 11 24H2? Why now?
It's about how the OS handles floating point exceptions and, crucially, memory initialization. For performance, Windows 11 24H2 doesn't always guarantee that certain types of memory are automatically zeroed out before use.
Okay. So before, that memory spot might have luckily been zero hiding the bug.
Exactly. Or the exception handling was different. Now, with that zero initialization guarantee gone for speed, the uninitialized variable contains whatever leftover junk was there.
Which scanf reads, leading to the infinite loop. Wow.
It's a fascinating chain reaction. Raymond Chen over at Microsoft wrote a great piece on it, really detailed analysis.
Yeah, I saw that link. People were praising the deep dive.
And it highlights that classic programming lesson, right? Hiram's Law. Every observable behavior of your system will be dependent upon by someone, eventually, even bugs.
Even accidental behavior, like memory happening to be zeroed out.
Precisely. The game inadvertently relied on that behavior.
So, looking back, could this have been caught earlier? I mean, even back in 2004.
Oh, definitely. Using debug builds during development, which have more checks enabled, might have flagged the uninitialized variable read.
Right.
And even back then, or certainly later, static analysis tools could have spotted potential issues. Dynamic analysis tools, too, like Valgrind or Address Sanitizer, they're built for exactly this kind of memory error detection.
And maybe just not using scanf for complex parsing.
That too.
Yeah.
More robust parsing libraries are generally safer. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? The same studio, Rockstar North, famously had those huge loading time issues in GTA Online for years.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Because of a really inefficient hand-roll JSON parser they wrote. Sometimes using the standard, well-tested tools is just better.
A lesson learned the hard way, maybe twice. Okay, shifting gears completely. Fonts. You wouldn't steal a font. It definitely evokes that old anti-piracy ad.
It does. And this article explores the perspective of font creators, the foundries. They argue, you know, that designing high-quality fonts takes skill and time, and licensing fees support that work.
Makes sense. Craftsmanship costs money. But the counter-argument is strong, too, right? With things like Google Fonts.
Absolutely. The piece acknowledges that there are tons of excellent, high-quality, open-source fonts available completely legally and for free. It makes the case for piracy a bit harder to swallow for some.
Yeah, I mean, most operating systems come with pretty decent default fonts now, too. So the argument is, like, why pirate Comic Sans when you have perfectly good free options?
Sort of. Though maybe not Comic Sans specifically. But yes, the availability of good, free, and default options weakens the need to pirate for basic use.
But there are times when you do need a specific font, yeah, like for a company's branding or if you're publishing something.
Definitely. If you're shipping software that embeds fonts, or designing a book, or maintaining a brand's visual identity, typography is critical. Licensed fonts give you specific designs, weights, and that legal certainty.
The article brought up Arial versus Helvetica as an example driven by licensing costs. Can you explain that a bit?
Sure. Helvetica was, and is, a popular but often licensed font. Microsoft commissioned Arial, partly as a cheaper alternative that was metrically compatible,
Metrically compatible.
meaning the characters take up the same amount of space width-wise. So you could swap Arial in for Helvetica in a document, and the layout, the line breaks, page breaks wouldn't change drastically. It was a pragmatic, cost-saving move.
Clever. Are there other reasons besides cost or pure aesthetics to choose specific fonts, like functional reasons?
Well, for sure, legibility is key. Think about coding fonts, for instance. You absolutely need to distinguish between a zero and a capital O, or a lowercase l in the number one.
Right, that can cause real problems if they look too similar.
Exactly. So the distinctness of characters in certain fonts is a major functional benefit in technical contexts or anywhere clarity is paramount.
The article also mentioned the font used in that old You Wouldn't Steal a Car ad, Expand Rough, and it might be a clone itself.
Yeah, that was a fascinating rabbit hole. Apparently, Expand Rough looks very much like another font, FF Confidential. If it is a direct digital copy, that's legally problematic, especially for an anti-piracy campaign to use.
The irony.
Right. And the copyright history involving the original Expand service, Catapult Entertainment, and GameSpy just adds more layers. It's complicated.
It makes you think about what copyright even is fundamentally. Is it about morality or just a legal tool?
The article kind of leans towards the latter view that copyright and patents are essentially temporary monopolies granted by the government to encourage creation and innovation, not necessarily based on some inherent moral right to the creation itself.
Interesting perspective. Okay, let's move to something potentially more serious. DOGE Workers Code supports NLRB whistleblower. DOGE as in Department of Government Efficiency.
Seems so, and the allegations are quite severe. A whistleblower claims that this DOGE team got high-level admin access at the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. And allegedly, they did this without proper logging and downloaded a lot of sensitive data stuff about union drives, confidential company info.
Wow, and there's code involved. This async a blob rotator.
Yeah, code found on GitHub, supposedly linked to a DOGE worker on the project. It's been heavily criticized by security folks online as being, well, fundamentally insecure. Bad engineering.
How so? What's the problem with it?
From the descriptions, it seems to use something called API Gateway as a sort of proxy, but in a way that could leak underlying AWS account IDs. Basically, a potentially major security screw-up.
Not good. And the whistleblower also mentioned they asked to skip the logging.
That's another key allegation that the DOGE personnel asked for their account activity not to be logged, which, you know, immediately raises red flags. Why would you need to hide your tracks unless?
Unless you're doing something you shouldn't be, or something unauthorized.
Precisely. And the level of access they reportedly got was apparently enormous, even more than the NLRB's own tech chief, the CIO.
That just doesn't sound right for an efficiency review.
It really doesn't. And then there's the deeply disturbing claim about a threatening note with drone photos being left at the whistleblower's home.
Okay, that's chilling. That takes it to a whole different level.
Absolutely. It makes the whole situation feel much darker.
So what are people speculating? Is this just massive incompetence by the DOGE team or something more sinister?
The interpretations really run the gamut. Could it be gross incompetence, people in over their heads with powerful tools? Or could it be intentional, trying to gather intel, maybe plant fake data, even espionage? The lack of logging and high access fuels the worst-case theories.
What about the legality? If they were told to access this data by higher-ups, is it still illegal?
That's a murky legal area. Authorization is key. Even if a superior ordered it, was that order itself lawful? Did it violate data privacy rules or laws governing NLRB data? Accessing sensitive union or business info without proper justification, even if ordered, could still be illegal.
This whole thing feels like it feeds into that broader narrative about distrust of government agencies, and maybe even pushes the argument for more AI in government to avoid human error or bias.
You could definitely see it being framed that way. When you have incidents raising questions about human judgment, security practices, and potential misuse of power, the idea of supposedly impartial AI might seem appealing to some. Whether that's realistic is another question.
Okay, let's pivot to AI directly. AI horseless carriages. That title suggests some skepticism about AI assistants, right? Like comparing them to early clunky cars.
Exactly. The author is basically saying that current AI, especially for things like helping with email, often feels underdeveloped, not quite ready for prime time.
What are the main complaints?
A big one is the lack of genuine human touch. AI-generated text can feel generic, bland, missing the sender's actual voice or nuance. You know, that personal connection gets lost.
I can see that. And privacy concerns too, presumably.
Oh yeah, that's huge. The worry that the AI is reading all your personal emails and might misuse that data, sell it, or just leak it somehow, it's a definite trust issue.
The article also mentioned AI summaries for short messages being pointless and AI expansions just adding semantic noise.
Right. Like if someone sends a two-sentence email, you don't need an AI to summarize it. And if you ask the AI to flesh out a short idea, it often just adds wordiness without real substance. Fluff.
Semantic noise is a good term for it. And the idea that AI doesn't really grasp context well.
Yeah, that it might misunderstand the situation, miss subtle cues, or introduce irrelevant points because its understanding of the real world context is, well, artificial and incomplete.
There was a comparison to note-taking in meetings, too, how humans synthesize things differently.
The point was that a human taking notes can actively listen, pick up on disagreements, understand the flow, and actually synthesize different viewpoints into a coherent summary. AI might just transcribe or pull out keywords without that deeper understanding.
Plus the practical issues, like an AI getting confused if it's listening to back-to-back meetings without a clear break.
Exactly. Context bleed over. And then there's vibe writing, using AI to tweak the tone. The author seemed a bit dismissive of that.
Like focusing on sounding friendly instead of just being clear.
Kind of. Maybe seeing it as potentially superficial. Style over substance.
But there are potential upsides mentioned, right? Like for non-native speakers or toning down angry emails.
Absolutely. The article acknowledges AI can be genuinely useful for polishing language, checking grammar, or helping someone rephrase an emotional message more diplomatically. That seems like a valid use case.
And it didn't dismiss all AI progress, mentioning things like video generation getting really good.
Right. It acknowledges that in some creative areas, AI is making huge strides, allowing small teams to do impressive things. It's more focused on the personal assistant role for communication.
The different agendas behind AI profit, accessibility, control, that's important context too.
Definitely. Who is building this AI and why? That shapes what the AI becomes. The article even draws a parallel to the blockchain hype cycle, suggesting maybe AI is currently in that inflated expectations phase for some applications.
Ultimately, it seems to argue that human communication has this core element. Empathy, nuance, shared understanding, that AI just can't replicate yet.
That's the central thesis, I think. Communication is more than just data transfer.
And security risks. Prompt injection was mentioned for AI email.
Yeah, that's a real worry. Tricking the AI by crafting specific input messages to make it do things it shouldn't, like leak information or click malicious links. If the AI is handling your email, that's a big attack surface.
The comparison to an underperforming employee kind of summed up the frustration, didn't it?
It did. That feeling that the AI tries, but often misses the mark or needs constant supervision, much like a human employee who isn't quite cutting it.
Okay, last big topic. Apple and Meta getting fined big bucks in the EU, millions of euros.
Yeah, these are significant. Apple got hit with, what, 500 million?
That's the number. And the reason was stopping app developers from telling users they could buy things cheaper outside the app store.
Exactly. The EU calls that anti-competitive behavior, basically preventing developers from steering users to alternatives where Apple doesn't take its cut. They see it as rent-seeking.
But Apple must have a defense, right? They run the store, provide the platform, the free rider argument.
Oh, absolutely. Apple argues they invest billions in the App Store ecosystem. The tools, the review process, the security, distribution, the commission helps pay for that. Letting developers easily bypass their payment system means those developers benefit from the ecosystem without contributing financially.
It's a classic platform dilemma. What about Meta's fine? That was $200 million.
Yes, and that was for their pay your consent model for ads.
Where you either agree to be tracked for personalized ads or you pay a subscription fee.
Right. The EU's Digital Markets Act, DMA, has rules against forcing users into tracking for targeted ads without real, freely given consent. The EU argues that making users pay to avoid tracking isn't truly free consent. you're essentially penalized for choosing privacy.
And these are called procedural fines, meaning?
It means they're fines specifically for not complying with the DMA's rules and procedures yet. It's the EU flexing its enforcement muscle, saying, we told you the rules, now follow them, or else.
The or else being potentially even bigger fines down the road.
Exactly.
We often hear free speech arguments when tech platforms moderate content, but how does that apply here with business models?
It mostly doesn't, legally speaking, especially not US First Amendment concepts applied to EU competition law.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't about censoring speech. It's about market practices the EU deems unfair or anti-competitive under the DMA. The debate is more around economic freedom versus regulation.
It does feel like these companies have gotten so big, regulation was almost inevitable, doesn't it?
That's the argument many regulators are making globally, that companies like Apple and Meta have become gatekeepers with so much market power that specific rules are needed to ensure fairness for competitors and consumers.
So it's this tension, freedom for companies to set their terms versus antitrust rules to prevent monopolies or abuses of power.
Precisely. And the EU, perhaps with its history and stronger memory of data misuse, seems particularly focused on reining in data collection and platform power.
People sometimes say US companies get targeted unfairly by the EU. Is that fair?
Well, the DMA applies to any company designated a gatekeeper based on size and impact in the EU market. It just so happens that many of the biggest global tech players meeting those criteria are US-based. The rules themselves are meant to be origin neutral.
So the idea is that this actually helps smaller European competitors.
That's certainly one of the stated goals. By preventing gatekeepers from self-preferencing or locking out rivals, the DMA aims to create more space for smaller players and innovation.
And the whole targeted advertising thing, it feels like the tide is turning against tracking everywhere.
There's definitely a growing pushback, both from regulators and users. People are more aware of privacy, maybe experiencing ad fatigue. The EU is clearly pushing for more explicit opt-in consent models.
Could companies like Apple or Meta just pull out of Europe if they don't like the rules?
Theoretically, yes. Realistically, extremely unlikely. The EU is a massive, wealthy market. Leaving would mean sacrificing enormous revenue. It's far more likely they'll fight the regulations in court while also working towards compliance, however reluctantly.
So these fines are basically the EU putting its foot down, signaling they're serious about enforcing the DMA to reshape the digital market.
That sums it up well. It's a clear statement about competition, user rights, and who holds the power in the digital economy within their borders.
Well, there you have it. From a 20-year-old gaming bug resurrected by a Windows update to font fights, serious government tech allegations, AI growing pains, and massive EU fines for tech giants.
All from today's Hacker News front page. It really shows the sheer breadth of what's happening.
Yeah, and hopefully we've given you a bit more context than just the headlines.
That's always the aim, to get behind the stories a little.
And thinking about all these connections today, old code, new OS, AI, regulation, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? What seemingly minor tech thing happening now might blow up into something huge years down the line?
It's a great question. You always have to consider those potential ripple effects, the underlying mechanics and motivations driving things in the tech world. It's rarely just about the surface issue.
Definitely something to chew on. Thanks for diving deep with us today.